Hello, on this week's program, Susan Lewis finds her way to The Salon, a monthly concert series at a private residence in Center City, Philadelphia that's been packing them in for almost 20 years. Jason Pfeiffer takes a look at Daughters of Genius, a new comedy from 1812 Productions. The play looks into the lives of the 17th century poet John Milton and his three daughters. And in our regular exploration of the Culture File section at gophila.com, we visit the neighbours at Alfred's Alley, the oldest continuously inhabited street in the nation. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
In 19th century Europe, classical chamber music concerts were often held in private homes. In 21st century Philadelphia, a version of this practice is flourishing at one address. The Salon, a musical meeting of minds, happens once a month, but it's not advertised except by email to select recipients. This is probably about as underground as serious music gets, and one recent Sunday evening, WRTI's Susan Lewis responded to an invitation and found herself in a small street in a residential neighborhood in Center City, Philadelphia.
Here we are, down a little alley, and here's the door. People are milling around. We have to take off our shoes. Does anyone object to taking off their shoes?
Not usually. I've never met someone who did.
A lot of nice shoes here.
It's a way of keeping that informality. It makes it different from the concert hall.
Andrea Clearfield welcomes us to her home. One Sunday evening a month, bedrooms and studies become dressing rooms, and the living room becomes a stage. The place fills with musicians, enough for 10 separate performances of a variety of styles. A composer and musician herself, Andrea's been doing this since 1986. Although these evenings are reminiscent of 19th century European music salons, the music here extends beyond chamber music.
Although there is classical chamber music here, I wanted to also open it up to the other styles of music as well, jazz, world music, contemporary music, sometimes even dance and multimedia.
The audience is also different from, and more eclectic than, its 19th century counterpart. In the door walk friends, and friends of friends, and, well, anyone who's learned about the Salon, gotten on the email list, and actually found the place, like Ruthie Levikoff.
I was so excited that it was open to people, like you didn't have to be a great musician to come.
On the landing, one flight up, there's a request for a donation to cover expenses. Past that, people are chatting in clusters and wandering around. It's not clear whose audience and who's performing. One woman is Sophia Sergi, a composer originally from Cyprus, here by way of Williamsburg, Virginia. She's waiting to hear the performance of her work, Sonic Sales.
Sonic Sales is a piece for solo violin and double bass with city background. So you have the live performers and a city is playing various wonderful sounds that are coming out of the speakers.
Down a bedroom hallway, or backstage hallway, other musicians are warming up.
My name is Patricia Haddad. I'm with the group Minas, and we're playing Brazilian music.
We run into Andrea, elegant in her cocktail dress and stocking feet. She introduces us to musicians Rich Rudin, Kenny Ulansky, Bruce Kaminsky, and Paul Butler. They're old-timers at the Salon and say that the eclectic nature of the music and the people draw them back year after year.
Rich, Kenny, and I have been performing at the Salon for 16, 17 years.
It's been a nice meeting point for new people and to see what kindred spirits are floating around town.
That is one of the things that keeps me coming back. And I never know who I'm going to run into, but I always know there's going to be somebody interesting. You never know what you're going to hear. In fact, there's a lot of instruments that are played here that I've never seen played before. Unusual instruments or just unusual music. The theremin.
Theremin, yeah.
That's an instrument that most people won't know what it is.
Unless they've watched a lot of horror movies.
Right. But they won't have ever seen it in concert. Hey, good, Paul.
It's about showtime, so we make our way to the darkened living room with its high A-frame ceiling. Spotlights mounted on exposed beams light the performance space at the edge of the room. Some people sit on chairs lined up around the walls. The rest sit cross-legged or stretched out on the floor. There are men and women of all ages, and even a few teenagers, like Ezra from Philadelphia, here for his second time.
My dad's been here a couple times, and I decided one time to go with him, and I was pleasantly surprised at the different kinds of music that I heard.
At 7:30, Andrea steps forward and welcomes us all to her home. She introduces the first musicians who wind their way from the back kitchen hallway through the crowd into the spotlights, and the concert begins. Tonight, over the course of 3 hours, we'll hear, among other things, new jazz, flute variations, a classical sonata, and original works for guitar. Music played by performers from Barcelona, Virginia, and students from the Curtis Institute of Music, a few blocks away. Andrea introduces each act with the pride of a musical mother, and the audience responds with the enthusiasm of a big extended family, eagerly anticipating each new performer. This is part of what makes it so special, say the artists.
Well, it creates a very friendly environment for musicians to perform. It's a great place to try out, experiment new things. The audience, you know, you don't come expecting something. The element of surprise is there. And also the diverse musicians, I think, that come from various parts of this country or even the world. And that it's somebody's living room.
By the end of this musical evening, it's clear that for Andrea Clearfield herself, Salon is about more than music.
I love to bring people together. People learn about different styles of music. There's also something very healing about it as well.
Ultimately, the musicians, the audience, even the volunteers putting out the cheese and crackers are all here for the same thing. Music, yes, but also this way of experiencing music in an intimate space. Andrea Clearfield, who's been inviting people to this event for almost 20 years, calls the Salon an adventure. There for the sharing with like-minded explorers who don't mind kicking off their shoes and making themselves at home.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The 17th century English writer John Milton is best known for his epic poem Paradise Lost. Milton's account of Satan's rebellion and Adam and Eve's expulsion from the Garden of Eden has captured the imagination of readers and scholars for centuries. At some point in your schooling, there's a good chance you've read parts of this poem. But don't feel bad if you never got around to reading the entire work. Divided into 12 books, it's rather long. And you now have a chance to brush up a little bit on your Miltonian verse with 1812 Productions in Philadelphia. They're staging Daughters of Genius, a world premiere play about John Milton and his daughters that takes place as the Paradise Lost masterpiece is being written. WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer has more on this unlikely comedy.
Evan Smith, the playwright of Daughters of Genius, is quick to admit that subject matter like John Milton and Paradise Lost doesn't automatically lend itself to humor.
It's a tendency I have that I'm trying to break, to just kill the part of me that wants to make plays about things that seem extremely untheatrical, or that people would say, why the heck would you want to make a play about that?
Despite his awareness that a comedy about John Milton and his daughters might be a hard sell, Smith went ahead with writing the show anyway, which is now in previews and opens this Wednesday. The inspiration for Daughters of Genius came when Smith was in college, and he took a class on John Milton. He became especially intrigued by various footnotes he came across within the works of the English poet. Milton, who probably suffered from glaucoma, was nearly blind as he completed Paradise Lost, and had to rely on the assistance of his daughters to write down his poetry. As shown in this scene with David Howie as John Milton and Dawn Filato as Anne, Milton's daughter, the poet is reluctant to educate his daughters as he dictates his masterpiece to them.
Teach me Latin.
Impossible.
Nighty-night then, Father. I'll check on you in the morning.
Wait, look... If I teach you a bit of Latin, enough for you to see that it holds no interest for you, will you take dictation?
I'll think about it.
It is agreed. Gather pen and paper. ready?
Ready.
Spangled with eyes more numerous than those of Argus.
No. Latin first, then poem.
I give you my word, I'll teach you Latin tomorrow.
Latin first.
Anne... I command you. I am your father.
I've got your cane.
Many aspects of Daughters of Genius are, of course, fiction. But contentiousness within the Milton family is well documented, according to Evan Smith. He says, for example, when Milton grew blind, His daughters stole books out of his library and sold them, keeping the money for themselves.
There was just boundless domestic discord. And, you know, domestic discord always is a fun topic.
The fun part of the play for David Howie, who plays John Milton, is the hybrid of comedy and old-fashioned language. Howie, whose acting career spans 3 decades, says he's always been drawn to the work of classic writers like Shakespeare. And with the poetry of Milton, Smith's Daughters of Genius taps into that tradition.
Uniquely, he has a contemporary voice, which gives me the same juices, gets the same juice flowing on the language as a Shakespearean play. In this play, I get to quote chunks of Paradise Lost. But on top of that, I also get the chance to be funny. So you don't get to my age as an actor without knowing what you do best. So it's the combination of playing crusty old men who are funny, who speak wonderful language.
The premiere of Daughters of Genius came to 1812 Productions after Evan Smith saw the company stage his successful play, The Uneasy Chair, a few years ago. Pleased with 1812's interpretation of the comedy, he offered them the chance to produce Daughters of Genius first. Artistic director Jennifer Childs was at the helm of 1812's Uneasy Chair and now directs Smith's John Milton play. She explains the new show breaks new ground for 1812 Productions, a relatively small company that's only been around for about 8 years.
It's our first world premiere by an established playwright, and it's the biggest physical production we've ever done. It includes flying and exploding angels and people transforming into devils and aerial battles and ladders, magical ladders descending from heaven, the usual, really, for other theater companies, but really new for us.
As the play integrates classic literature with a contemporary comedic sensibility, Jennifer Childs describes Daughters of Genius as John Milton meets Mel Brooks. Perhaps for those students of Milton's work who have a hard time finding enthusiasm for the 17th century writer, Daughters of Genius is a good entry point into his poetry. At the very least, it probably beats reading all 12 books of Paradise Lost.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. 1812 Productions' Daughter of Genius is at the St. Stephen's Theatre at 10th and Ludlow Streets in Philadelphia through June 18th. Now in our regular dip into the culture file section at gophila.com, we visit Alfred's Alley. When a street is called an alley, two fairly different images come to mind. Either a small, quaint laneway with a secret beauty, or something small, dark, dank, and seedy, with maybe even a couple of scrawny cats lurking in the shadows. Alfred's Alley in Old City Philadelphia has been both types of street over the past 300 years, but these days it's far more like the former. Quaint. The compact cobblestone street is lined with tiny row houses garnished with colourful flower boxes and colonial touches. The alley is tucked away in a neighbourhood that has seen significant renewal in the past decade. Factories have been converted into condos and corner produce stores into art galleries and upscale boutiques and restaurants. This urban revitalization is just the latest of many changes the alley has seen over the past 3 centuries, among them a revolution, a civil war, and the invention of the automobile. Today, the country's oldest continuously occupied residential street, in addition to the busloads of tourists, still has real people living here. Unlike many of the neighbouring historic sites like Betsy Ross House and Independence Hall, Alfred's Alley is not frozen in the colonial Philadelphia time capsule, although upon first glance it may appear to be, with its 18th century charm very much intact. Executive Director Robert Vosburgh explains why a visit to Alfred's Alley is more than just a glimpse into Philadelphia's beginnings.
People often associate Alfred's Alley just with colonial history, and it is a colonial street. But what makes it so important is that it's a place where there's a 300-year continuum of history. It's not just about colonial history. Those who shaped Philadelphia in the 19th century and the 20th century are just as significant to interpreting this site as the 18th century origins of the street. Here on Alfred's Alley, you can really trace enormous societal trends, economic, social, political, cultural, those of different waves of immigration.
Standing only 250 yards from the Philadelphia waterfront, the alley was an ideal location for merchants to set up business in their homes at a time when Philadelphia's port was the busiest in the country. Comparing Alfred's Alley to New York's Lower East Side tenement houses, Vosburgh explains that a visit is a glimpse into the lives of the people historical tours sometimes overlook.
We have records of over 3,000 past residents on Elfrith's Alley. So it's an incredible resource for really doing social history. Again, the people on Elfrith's Alley were working class people, tradesmen. So anything from a chair maker to a dressmaker, pottery works, tin works, commercial bakery, silversmiths, pewtersmiths, sailmakers, barrel makers, rope makers, you name it.
The preservation of the street began in 1934 when resident Dolly Otte caught wind that two of the houses were to be demolished. Dolly got the neighbours together to buy up the properties and form the Elfrith's Alley Association, an act Robert Vosburgh says was highly unusual for that time.
This is early in the American Preservation Movement, and the first focus is going to be on large mansion houses, grand civic monuments, and that's what the Society for the Preservation of Landmarks was focusing on. So it's extraordinary that anyone had the presence of mind in the 1930s to recognize the significance of this working-class housing. At that point in the late 19th century, early 20th century, in many respects it was run down. It was affordable housing for folks who were working in the industrial center of Old City, Philadelphia. And it just showed incredible foresight that saving this kind of working class architecture was important.
This foresight became a tradition on Elfrith's Alley. In the 1950s, the street was threatened by the construction of I-95. Once again, neighbors rallied together and got the interstate rerouted. Again, saving the alley, while many other 18th century homes along the waterfront met the wrecking ball. Today, 30 of the 32 houses on the street are still private residences. The other two houses are owned by the Elfrith's Alley Association and are open to the public for museum tours and by appointment to research the archives. House number 126 was the home of a female dressmaker. The bottom floor of the narrow row home is set up like her shop, with a simple but frail-looking dress laid out, as if she'll be back to finish the job at any moment. Upstairs, the living space demonstrates just how minimal 18th century living was on the alley. Robert Vosburgh points to a sparsely furnished small room and gives the 19-second tour.
This is really the extent of the rest of the house. This is the bedroom, it's a workroom, it's the dining room, it's the living room, it's even the bathroom, if you will. There's a chamber pot down there below the bed. There were not separate outhouses or privies for the folks on Elfrith's Alley. Rather, there was a communal privy where people would take their chamber pots to empty them out, located all the way down the street on Bladen's Court.
But what about today? What about these people who choose to live on a block visited by over 200,000 people each year? They no longer have to take the chamber pot to the end of the block, but what's it like to live on a street that's a tourist attraction? Current resident Karen Cronin is walking down the alley with her young son Alden.
It's fun. It's a nice community street. It's fun to educate the tourists about our area that we live in, and it's a fun, nice family place.
Part of living on this street is accepting that visitors will be curious, says Kelly McCabe, who lived on the alley for 6 years.
Nobody's trying to be invasive, but most people didn't understand that there were actual people who lived there. A lot of people really think it's Williamsburg or it's some sort of historic village populated by actors.
To satisfy the public instinct for voyeurism, some residents of Elfrith's Alley open their houses twice a year, once in the winter and once in June for the annual Fete Day, a tradition that has continued since 1934 and was started by the first group of residential preservationists. This is when visitors see the evidence of the diversity of the alley. Although the outside may be the epitome of the 18th century, the insides are what the street has always been, says Robert Vosburgh.
Now, there's this tendency to look at these houses and think how quaint and cute they are, and that, you know, mustn't the people that have lived here before have been quaint, cute little people? But I was having a great conversation with Dick Tyler, previous director of the Philadelphia Historical Commission, and he said, remember, Elfrith's Alley was a mean, dirty little alley built for mean, dirty little people. Now, the reality is that neither one of those statements is true. You know, they weren't mean, dirty little people, and they weren't quaint, cute little people. They weren't little, they were our size. But just like today, the society is more complex, more nuanced than that. It's interesting how we interpret history, and we want it to either be the good old days or the bad old days, and we don't recognize that it was somewhere in between.
More information on Elfrith's Alley is available at the Culture File section of gophila.com. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Anthony Barakas, Megan Smedley, and Debbie Fleischman. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.